This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Today, listeners, I invite your questions for writer Gina Nahai. She's a frequent lecturer on Iranian politics and the repression of women and Jews in Iran. Her first two novels, Cry of the Peacock and Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, involved a world and a people largely unknown here in the West, the Jews of Iran. Gina Nahai's new novel, Sunday's Silence, is set within the United States. But again, Nahai sets the story in a world unknown to most of us, Appalachia. The novel examines religious fanaticism in Appalachia. The novel opens in Kentucky and Beirut. Adam Watkins, a successful foreign correspondent in the Mideast, comes home to Kentucky to investigate the death of his father, a holy roller and snake-handling preacher. After handling thousands of snakes and surviving hundreds of snake bites, little Sam Jenkins is dead. He dies after handling a snake given to him by a member of the Church of Southern Hope and Redemption, Sister Blue Curdy. Blue is a mysterious and powerful woman, a beautiful woman, born halfway around the world in Kurdistan, brought to Kentucky some 20 years earlier as the 14-year-old bride of a much older man. Gina Nahai holds degrees in international relations and in writing. She was born in Iran and raised in Switzerland and Los Angeles. She is currently an adjunct professor of creative writing at the University of Southern California. Listeners, you can join the discussion with your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Gina Nahai's new book, Sunday's Silence, is published by Harcourt. Gina, good afternoon. Welcome back to the Afternoon Magazine.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Last we talked about Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith.
Right. That was about 3 years ago.
Yeah. 1999, maybe?
Right.
Yeah. Now, you were born in Iran, as I mentioned, and then raised in Switzerland and Los Angeles. When did you become interested in Appalachia?
I've been interested in Appalachia for a very long time, for almost as long as I've been in this country. I think extremes in most cultures have always fascinated me, and the Appalachia has such parallels, I think, with many parts of the third world, from the way women are treated to the way lives are in so many ways insulated from what goes on in the rest of the world. And geographically, it's a fascinating place, and historically, it's a fascinating place. So it's just been a labor, really, of love and interest to find out more and more, enough to be able to write about it.
Yeah. Now, putting your interest in the region into your work as a writer just seems natural, doesn't it? But I'm wondering when and how the characters in the story began to take shape for this book.
The very first time I thought, God, I could write about a novel about this was when I read an article in a magazine about women in Appalachia and how girls marry at ages 12 and 14 to men much older than themselves. And give themselves and their lives away so easily. There was an interview I read with a girl who'd married her grandfather's childhood friend. She was 14 and the gentleman was in his 70s. When the reporter had asked, why did you do this, she said, because he took me to McDonald's in Pineville and let me order a second milkshake on our first date. Mm-hmm. And I thought, look, I've been writing about these lives in faraway Middle Eastern places, and right here in America, this kind of thing goes on all the time.
Yeah. Well, unless you have a wider world view, it's very easy to be suckered in by a second milkshake, isn't it?
It is, and for a writer, I think it's an advantage to have come here from the outside or anywhere. When you do feel sort of an outsider, it's easier to look at all the variations within a culture. And also, obviously, the religious fanaticism, the fundamentalism, there's such parallels between Christian fundamentalism in this country and the Islamic fundamentalism, Jewish fundamentalism in the rest of the world. And that was something that I thought was worth exploring for us to understand why and how things happen in the Middle East, for instance, or the Muslim world. It's important to understand how they happen in this country.
Yeah. What is the function of fundamentalism?
Well, in many ways, I think fundamentalism provides an answer for all the pain and the sense of loss that many people feel. Obviously, it's easier to take hold in economically deprived areas. But beyond that, I think in Appalachia, for instance, those people have felt betrayed by so-called city folk, by the educated people for so long, all the coal miners, all the original settlers were driven off their land so easily by the government and by the iron companies and coal companies. And here is a community, here's a religion that offers a sense of community and support that in many ways is unconditional. Beyond that, though, I think it's a question of education. It's a question of the power of the clergy versus the power of secular education that really trains these people from a very young age to believe in what is not visible to the eye and what is often not logical to the mind.
Hmm. Now, in Sunday's Silence, where we become acquainted with snake handlers, and I understand snake handling in this context to be about faith, but it is also about more than that. There's a curious connection between faith and fear, and I also think entertainment.
Well, I don't know about what kind of entertainment it does provide, but this whole novel really is about faith, religious and other kinds of faith, and about the extremes to which this faith can be pushed. Snake handlers take literally a passage in the Bible, Mark 17, in which the Lord says, "And these signs shall follow those who believe. In my name you shall take up poisonous serpents and drink any deadly thing, and nothing will harm you." And they believe that if they have enough faith in the Lord, when they are in church in mid-prayer, they will reach a state of anointment in which the Spirit of the Lord enters their bodies. And they handle these snakes at grave danger to themselves in order, A, to conquer, they think, the devil, and also to prove the extent of their faith in the Lord. They also drink battery fluid and lye and Drano and handle live wires and fire.
Mm-hmm.
What is most fascinating, though, is not that they do this. It's that they seem to be largely immune, indeed, to bodily harm. The character in the book, the preacher who founded the snake handling movement, was bitten 446 times by snakes before he finally caught one that killed him. There's really no scientific explanation for why this happens, why these people survive these snake bites and the poison. And so in that regard, I do think that their faith and their prayer does provide a certain level of immunity to them.
But this character, Sam Jenkins, he's charismatic. And maybe, you know, I used the word entertainment earlier. Maybe that's not the right word. I don't know what the right word is, but there is something.
Charisma is a good word.
Yeah, charisma. There is something there that captures you and takes you away.
Well, I think the fact that he is so fearless and the others are so fearless, the other preachers, in many ways it overcomes for the believers all of the discrepancies in these leaders' own personal lives. Here's a man who's told his followers forever that divorce is unholy and second marriages are not recognized by the Lord, and he's known to have had four wives and many lovers. Here's a man who moonshines and fights and steals and preaches to the followers about honesty. And that seems to be the case, not just among the holy rulers, but really everywhere religion has a stronghold. The followers tend to put their faith more in the message than in the messenger. And for that reason, they're willing to forgive the messenger all of his own human so-called failures in order to receive that message. And that seems to be what keeps them going.
What kind of research did you do for Sunday Silence?
I had to do two different kinds of research. Half of the book brings together the culture of the eastern half of the world with this culture in the United States, what I think of as the most advanced Western country. And so I had to study the culture and the religion of the Kurds, who are the mountain people in Iran and Iraq and Turkey, and all of their history. And for the American part of the story, I studied the history of coal miners and the history of religion in this country, how the Baptists and the Methodists and Pentecostals came into these regions and why. And then after a couple of years, when I really knew what parts of Appalachia I wanted to see, I went there by myself, and I rented a little green, some sort of Japanese car, and I drove through all these places, through all the ghost towns and the abandoned coal mining towns of Kentucky and Tennessee and West Virginia through Cumberland Gap. And that was an experience that I recommend to anyone, but that I will certainly never forget.
It's a place about as different from Los Angeles as you can find in the United States.
Oh, I think it's a place about as different as any other part of the United States. The truth is, though, it's geographically, it is stunning. And also, though, because of the mountains and because the region is so insulated physically by these mountains from the rest of the country, the minute you arrive there, you do have a sense that you are in a world unto itself, that the laws and the traditions of the other parts of the world cannot quite take hold here. Because you wake up every morning to these, you know, these beautiful rivers and waterfalls and mountains, but you really do feel that you are on your own. And I think the Appalachian people have always felt that they were alone against the rest of the world.
How did you go about settling in, making yourself, opening yourself to the experience of this region of the United States? How did you, it seems to me one would have to sort of clear one's head and open oneself up to was around.
I tried as much as possible to clear my head of any sort of fear of being here alone in, you know, that the stereotypes of deliverance and so on, being lost in these mountains among hostile people, which is not at all what really happens on a daily basis anyway. But I went there, perhaps because I wasn't raised in this country, I didn't have the sort of prejudice and stereotypes that some people do seem to have about Appalachia. I really went there because I wanted to understand the place and the people. And I tried. It wasn't always easy. You're not accepted easily. People don't want to make conversation with someone who is an outsider. I'd walk into a place in Knoxville, and before I had opened my mouth, somebody would say, "You're not from here." And that pretty much was the beginning and the end of the conversation. On the other hand, once people do open themselves up, then you see a culture that is in many ways very gentle, very welcoming, and it seems like those people have that old sense of community that we used to know in the Middle East, that you belong. There's a sense that they belong with each other. They really don't want to know. There are people in Knoxville, Tennessee, who are very proud of the fact that they have never left the South, that they've never been anywhere else in the world but the South, and that anything they ever need is right there in the South.
Yeah. You know, thinking about Knoxville, Tennessee, you know, we're not all that far away from Knoxville, Tennessee, and you know, I think of Knoxville, Tennessee as a metropolitan area.
Oh, yes, it absolutely is. It is a metropolitan area there, with a lot of culture, a lot of history. It's a beautiful city. In many ways, life there is a lot easier even for outsiders. I met a gentleman who was a gay poet, and there are these poetry readings they have on Sunday nights, and I said, "Don't you feel comfortable here as a poet and an openly gay person?" And he said, "Yes." He said that there are, you know, every country is many countries, and every people is many peoples, and it's possible over there too to find a little community of artists and poets who take care of each other. They do these Sunday night poetry readings that are not necessarily that great, but they provide a network of support for the artists.
One of the interesting things you've done in this book, Sunday Silence, you have one character coming to Appalachia from half a world away, and you have a character coming back from half a world away.
Right, and in many ways their lives mirror each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's one line where Adam, the son of the snake handler who has left and stayed away on purpose for 20 years, looks at this woman, this Kurdish woman, with whom he's having an adulterous affair, and he wonders if her life is not really his life, only in reverse. And towards the end of the story, there's a give and take. She is telling him her story, and you're not ever quite sure if she's telling the truth or if she's trying to seduce him with these tales so that he doesn't expose her lies, the lies that she's lived by all her life. And towards the end of the book, it becomes a question for Adam to either accept what she says on faith, because there's no physical evidence of her telling the truth, or to leave. And then it becomes, it mirrors the question of faith and religion that's always been there, which is, do we accept God even though we haven't seen him? Do we accept the words of his prophets even though we're not sure that they were actually spoken? That's the whole theme, back and forth. And at some point, it seems as if the Westerner and the Easterner have literally switched places.
Mm. And it also seems until they meet one another, they're moving through the world incognito.
Incognito. They're people who have never really belonged anywhere. And that obviously comes from my own experience of living in these countries and going through these places where I'm not ever quite a native, and perhaps never will be. And also the question of, to what extent can a person leave behind their past and reinvent oneself in the interest of a better future, which is what these people, all of them, all these characters have tried to do.
Adam, even coming home to Knoxville, he's not recognized as a local, and you write of him, Adam never told anyone about his beginnings. Partly he was ashamed, partly also he did not understand it well enough to explain it to others.
Right. He was abandoned. He was never recognized by his father, and he was eventually put at a young age by his mother in an orphanage. The reason he doesn't feel as if he is of these people is because he was given a good enough education in the orphanage to feel that he's different. Not that he's superior, but the secular education he received outweighed the sorts of truths or untruths that the preachers tell their people. But what happens, though, is after a while he does start feeling as if, no, he cannot escape his past. And so he's constantly searching the history, through his father's history and his other siblings' history, trying to confirm for himself that, no, he is not of these people. And then, of course, the rest of the book deals with the question of whether he is or isn't, really.
Hmm. Describe Blue, Sister Blue Curdy, for our listeners.
Blue is this gorgeous, purple-eyed, red-haired woman who's arrived here as the bride of a much older man, a professor of linguistics at the University of Tennessee. He has brought her to this place as an illiterate mountain girl and raised her literally from the age of 14, educated her, and sort of taught her the so-called ways of the civilized world. Because up until then, she'd lived a nomadic life with her family. And she has no faith in Jesus. She goes into this church following her husband, who's trying to study the language of the snake handlers, you know, when they start talking in tongues, mm-hmm. trying to understand if this is actually a language or if it's just noises that they make in prayer. And she stays, though, in the church, because for the first time in her life, these church people, the holy rollers, provide a system of support and kindness and friendship. And at some point in the story, she tells Adam, maybe this is all that faith is, the woman who comes to your house in the middle of the night and brings you a plate of cookies and sits with you and prays with you when you are otherwise lost and desperate. That's why she stayed in the church and fought to stay in the church. Obviously, she's a woman and an outsider. It's not easy to fit in.
Yeah, that's very interesting that you have her pulled into this world of the Holy Rollers, yet she is so yet far apart, far out of it, you know, far apart from it.
Yeah, see, the whole, what I have learned, I've lived in this country for 23 years, almost 24 years, and what I learned was, for all of the differences that we think we have, the so-called first-generation immigrants and the rest of America, we are more similar, really, than different. I used to think of ourselves, sort of the people from the Middle East, as very separate from Americans, that legally and in many other ways, yes, we are the same people, but that culturally we're not. And the longer I've stayed here, it isn't as if I feel any less Iranian or any less Jewish, but I have learned that in the most fundamental, basic ways, all human beings behave the same way.
Early in the book, while readers are getting some background on Adam, we find a reflection on connections between people and connections between people and place, and I found that very interesting. Adam's mother was a woman by the name of Claire Watkins. And Gina, if you have the book there, I'm referring to a section of the narrative on page 22 where Adam is reflecting on coming back to Kentucky.
Right.
Maybe you would pick this thought up here with the sentence that begins, "Too young to understand."
Too young, right. Do you want me to read it?
Please, if you would.
Right. "Too young to understand the snake handler's motives or the mystery of his face, too intimidated by Sam Jenkins to go near him, Adam had escaped Appalachia rather than pursue the answers that might have explained his own and his mother's fate. But the farther he had gone from the South, the more he had felt the weight of those questions, the certainty also that he had empowered Sam with his absence, that by removing himself as proof of Sam's indiscretion, he had bought the man impunity and allowed him to bury the truth with his lies. This much he had learned from his own childhood in Appalachia and from the years, too, of covering wars and witnessing atrocities. The greatest sin of all was to refuse to bear witness."
Mm. And by not bearing witness and by uprooting yourself, you have disconnected.
You have disconnected, but you've also carried all these sins around with yourself all the time. There is a culture within any fundamentalist society and religion that really intimidates anyone from speaking the truth, whatever that truth may be, from criticizing the so-called establishment, the religious establishment. And that's not particular to Christians. It's everywhere. And so what happens is that a lot of injustice is done, a lot of lies are told, and all of them are kept quiet in the interest of so-called religion, or in order not to air out one's dirty laundry, so to speak. And this is what he's come to fight, and the book, the story really does deal with this. To what extent is it better to keep silent or to speak up?
Yeah.
The professor, that Blue's husband, for instance, has been carrying this horrible secret around forever, thinking that if he gets far enough from his path, from the places of his birth, that he can actually bury the secret. And very late in the book, he's suddenly faced with the enormity of this lie that has grown, and so is Blue. That this lie has grown in its silence to the point where they cannot keep it quiet anymore.
Hmm. Well, I mean, this is very interesting, this conflict between keeping silence and keeping silent, and yet in order to achieve redemption, you know, one has to do, as Adam is thinking here early in the book, bear witness.
You have to bear witness. That's what he's done all his life as a reporter. Right. But what he learns when he comes back to Appalachia is that in many ways he's also done what he's blamed his father and his and the Holy Rollers for, which is he has kept silent about his own past, thinking that if he gets away far enough from it, he doesn't need to explain it to anyone. As you said, he is ashamed and he doesn't understand it is true. But mostly he's wanted to deny it, and there he doesn't bear witness. Also, as he gets more and more involved and in love with this woman who may have actually committed this murder, he is faced with the choice of speaking up and therefore handing her over to her so-called enemies, or keeping her secret and saving her.
Adam, as well as Blue, I imagine you feel quite at home with these two characters. Is that true?
Oh, yes, very much so.
Yeah.
I have traveled with these two characters for years now. There is, I think, for every fiction writer, but there's a real world, and then there is the world of your characters. And they're both there at the same time, all the time, at any given moment. I'm looking at the physical reality around me, but somewhere in the corner, there is Blue and there's Adam.
How did you come up with Blue's name?
I took Blue's name from a passage in my other book, Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, in which the character Roxana travels as far away again from her past, which is Iran, as she can possibly physically go, which is Turkey, and she has to stop at the Sea of Marmara, which is supposed to be one of the most beautiful sights in the world, the bluest sea. And in this book, the professor, when she brings Blue to this world, changes her name, tries to hide the fact that they're Jewish, joins the church, and gives this girl a new name. He says, I will name you Blue after the most beautiful body of water in the world, the Sea of Marmara. The theme of water, for some reason, has always played an important part in my novels. To me, I think bodies of water represent a certain level of freedom, being able to get away. And now I think perhaps having been raised in Tehran, which is a city at the bottom of a mountain range, very tall and beautiful and also forbidding, and it's in a desert part of the country, and to us always there was this journey that we would take sometimes across these mountains to the Caspian Sea, and the minute you reach the Caspian shore, it's as if the world has literally opened up. And I think that in my own consciousness has been reflected time and again in all these stories where these characters have a special relationship with rivers and waters and places that take you away.
Yeah. And, well, of course, water is such a powerful symbol in terms of its power at wearing things away and its ability to cleanse us and keeps.
And it's also an ability to deliver us of our harsher physical surroundings.
Mm. And in Christianity, it opens the door to the next life.
Right.
Yeah. And Blue also, in the book, early in the book, I believe, Adam who sees her as the name Blue as in the product that one would use to whiten your shirts.
Oh, what he says is,
yeah.
Yeah. At that point, he's just heard of Blue's name. But all of a sudden, he looks at his past and he thinks about the parallel between this name and the stuff that women in the Middle East use to whiten all the whites, which is this sort of purplish blue bleach that I remember as a child my mother and other women would pour into the water before they washed all the booze. And it's just a beautiful color anyway, when you put a little bit of it in a clear basin of water and all the water suddenly turns this deep, gorgeous blue. And so there you go. There's my own memories reflected in these books.
Yeah. Well, I remember my grandmother using that type of bleach as well, but I don't
In Iran, it was called Nile bleach, Nile after the river. And us kids would run around when my mother and the maids and everybody else was washing these clothes. We'd run around asking if we could pour this bleach into the water. And we'd put a little bit, and all of a sudden, it was like a miracle. It was wonderful.
When was the last time you were in Iran?
1977, the year before, the summer before I came to the United States. I went back to Iran from boarding school in Europe, and we stayed about 2 months, and that was before my parents moved to America as well. And that, when we left Iran, we left before the revolution. We left in spite of the fact that things were very good in Iran at the time for many people. But we left never imagining that we could not go back ever. And so our house was there, and my grandparents that we lived with were still in that house, and our clothes were hanging in the closets, and our beds and our belongings were there, and that was the last time we saw any of it.
Do you think there's any chance that you could go back in the near future?
Well, many people have been going back. It's a bit easier for Muslims to travel back and forth than for Jews or other minorities. But things certainly have changed in many ways in Iran, and they've stayed the same in many ways. So, yes, if I wanted to, I could go back. I'd probably be in a lot of trouble because of the books that I have written. But no one's going to prevent me from getting there. Whether they're going to allow me to leave is another story. The thing is, if you've been away from your home for so long, after a while, at least in my case, there is a fear that I'll go back and I will find everything changed so much that I won't recognize it. And there's also a fear that I'll go back and all of a sudden, as I did when I went back after many years to the town in Switzerland where we went to school, my sister and I, and I walked through this town and I walked through this school, and I kept seeing myself suddenly as the little 13-year-old who'd arrived there for the first time. And it's very difficult. It's a pleasant experience, and at the same time, it's very difficult to be able to see yourself as you once were. And it takes some courage. It would take a lot of courage for me right now to go back to Iran.
Are your books, I would imagine that they're not published in Iran, but I wonder if Iranians have read them in Iran.
Well, actually, my second book, Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, Iran doesn't have a copyright treaty with anybody. And so they can take and translate any book that they want from any language. And the first person to finish the translation actually gets the copyright to your book. So a woman in Iran has translated Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith, and she now owns the rights to my book. And she has been sending, the copies have been sent to all the Iranian Parsi language bookstores around this country and probably in Europe. And they're selling. It's a very bad translation, I'm sorry to say. But writers, unfortunately, have no control over that. Actually, this is just a little aside, but I heard that the best-selling book of all time in Iran is Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus.
No way.
Absolutely. But that tells a lot about, there is a lip service to, or there used to be at least, to everything that is bad and wrong with this country and evil and corrupting. And then there's the reality of it, which is American music, American films, American literature, everything else American is so loved in that country. And I have to say, in all of that region, in all of those countries, you see on camera a few people marching through Pakistan and demonstrating against the United States. What you do not see is the majority of the population who would actually feel quite delivered of their own despotic leaders if they were allowed to have a closer relationship with the West and especially America.
Yeah. Now, there's a large Iranian community in Los Angeles. What kind of relationship is there between that community and Iran at this stage?
By and large, most of the people, most of the Iranians who have left and settled in this country have come here because they have they much prefer this way of life. And so the relationship, you know, there are many radio stations, for instance, and a couple of television stations that broadcast 24 hours in Farsi, and a lot of them broadcast into Iran or are unavailable and heard on the Internet. And that has made communication a lot easier. People call these radio stations from Iran, talking about all the things that are harsh and difficult in their lives over there and what they feel about the government and so on. But for a while after the revolution, people talked about going back, or they spoke about all the things that were so much better in the old world. And that's really stopped. I think more and more everyone's realizing what a blessing and a gift it is to be able to be here and even be able to criticize what you don't like from this country without the fear of certain retaliation and, in a lot of cases, jail sentences and death for just speaking up your mind.
Since the terrorist attacks in September, have there been difficulties for the Iranian community in Los Angeles as being seen as other, as foreign, as outsiders,
you know,
as dangerous?
I have to say, not only have there not been any difficulties, there's been such an outpouring of support and expressions of friendship from the Americans. Iranians, in many ways, have had a difficult time being accepted in Southern California and Northern California, because they did come here with such large numbers, a different culture, different ways of life. And so it has been difficult over the years, but since September 11th, two things have happened. The Americans all around us really do feel that in order to preserve this way of life and thinking, it's important that we do respect the rights of immigrants, no matter how threatening they might seem. And also, most Iranians have suddenly found their sense of allegiance to this country solidified. Suddenly we're faced with this question of, well, what are we? Where do we, what side are we on? And it's very clear that we're on the side of this country, by and large. There are always exceptions.
Gina Nahai is our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Gina is the author of three novels, Cry of the Peacock, Moonlight on the Avenue of Faith. Her latest is Sunday's Silence. It is set within the United States, but again, she has set this story in a world unknown to most of us, Appalachia. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a question or comment. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Gina Nahai holds degrees in international relations and in writing. She was born in Iran and raised in Switzerland and in the United States. Again, those telephone numbers, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Gina, if we might go back to Sunday Silence.
Sure.
For a bit. The practice of handling snakes, of handling fire and drinking poison, do they continue today?
Oh, yes, they continue today in these church services. The churches mostly are not sort of established buildings and institutions. People meet in middle-of-the-way houses or abandoned gas stations, and some do have churches, but others meet in barns. And there are thousands of people across the Appalachian region. And interestingly enough, around the same time that the Holy Rolling Movement started in Appalachia, another one started in California. The one in California has not spread as fast or as well as the one in Appalachia. But yes, people do this today.
Let's talk with a listener on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I have something that has been puzzling me for a long time, and maybe your guest can help me with it.
Sure.
I've lived in New York State, and when I came here, the city north of us, and I pronounced it Kankakee. And I was corrected, it's Kankakee. In New York State, we've always pronounced the word Appalachian. Wow. And I was, since your guest has been in these areas, I would like to know what what the locals, how the locals pronounce it. And the Appalachian Mountains extend from south and go all the way north, I believe, into New York State. I'm not sure, but I know it's a long ridge that goes north and south. And since she's been in these areas, I wonder if she could kind of straighten this out for me and tell me how the locals in the southern area pronounce the word.
You know, they say both. They say Appalachia and Appalachia, and I don't really know what is more correct, but I've heard it said both ways for so long that I imagine it's to use both. I'm not sure.
In the areas where they live, do they pronounce it that way too down south?
Yeah.
Because I know they pronounce it which way? Oh, either way?
Either way, yeah.
Well, up in New York State.
I think in Knoxville, for instance, a lot of people said Appalachia and a lot of people said Appalachia. I imagine perhaps Appalachia is more correct, but I'm not sure what to tell you.
Yeah, I think, as the caller mentions, that region is a large one.
It's the mountains span over 14 states.
Yeah, and it goes from, as she mentioned, you know, New York, all the way down into the southern
Florida.
United States.
Yeah.
And some time back, I had a woman on the program from that region, a writer, and goodness forgive me now, her name escapes me. It's on the tip of my tongue, but she's from West Virginia.
Right.
And she said Appalachia.
Right.
So.
No, they say both.
They say both. And also, the caller mentioned Kankakee, and near Kankakee, there's a community that the people that live there are divided on how to pronounce their town's name.
Right.
Some will say Bourbonnais, and some will say Bourbonus. So it's one of those things that there's, in this instance, there's no one answer.
Right.
So I want to thank the caller for her call this afternoon. We're almost out of time, Gina, so I guess I'll wrap up with one last question here. And
sure.
it's not a serious one at all, but on the internet, I found an interview that you must have done some time ago when you were working on Sunday Silence.
Mm.
And that was the title of the novel. However, the novel was about a Russian woman who comes to America in the 1920s as a picture bride.
Oh, yes, that was an old interview. Well,
I was wondering how you went from the idea of, you know, still we had a young woman coming
right.
to this country as a bride.
Right.
But we moved from Russia to Kurdistan.
Well, what happened was a lot of these characters in this book and in the others are based on real people. I talk and do interviews and then I take these lives and make composites of them. But that Russian woman who came in as a picture bride, someone in Los Angeles, a woman once came up to me at a lecture and said, "You have to come to my house. I've got to tell you the most amazing story." She was an American woman, born and raised here. And then she told me the story of her mother who had come from Russia as a picture bride. And initially, this novel was going to be much longer, Sunday Silence, and it was going to tell the story of these immigrants who came and all those difficulties that that they faced to cross over. And, you know, there would have been another 200 pages in this book to have told that story. To be honest with you, I was doing this research right around the time that the Titanic film came out, and all of a sudden I saw all the hoopla about Titanic, and I just had no more interest in that. And so I cut it all out. It was about a year's worth of research and a good story, but I was so overexposed myself, just this Titanic thing going around, and I saw the film and thought nothing of it, never thought it was so fascinating as everybody else found it. And so, you know, the subject has to have a certain freshness for the writer, or we'll never be able to write well about it.
Yeah, huh. Would you like to say anything about what you're working on now?
I'm working on a new novel. It takes place partly in the offshore drilling oil fields of Alaska and partly in the oil fields of the Middle East. And the main character is a woman pilot whose job it is to fly these oil workers from the shore onto the offshore sites. They work in two-week shifts. They work for 2 weeks and they go home for 2 weeks. And there, again, is a whole culture and geography in a place that to me is fascinating. And the parallels with the Middle East and this whole question of oil and the greed and the title of the book is Desire, unless I change it later. You might find an old interview a couple of years from now. But right now the title is Desire, and it's about this desire for all the different things in life that we seek.
Very good. Well, I look forward to it.
Oh, thank you so much. This was a pleasure to do.
Thank you, Gina.
Thanks.
Gina Nahai has been our guest this afternoon. Her latest book, Sunday's Silence, it's published by Harcourt.